First of all, I said, you don't take my money without my permission. I said, I don't go for that kind of stuff. I said, you're handling my money, and you have to check with me. What I heard was they got a tremendous bonus. They told him how much money I had that they were bringing in, and they gave a big bonus first. And if I call him, what's going on? He says, I can't talk to you now. I'm very, very busy. I can't talk to you now. He managed my money for himself.
Meet Beverly Schottenstein.
I am Beverly Schottenstein. I was born on June 13, 1926. I am 94 years old.
Beverly's been gaslighted, she's been defrauded, she's been plain old ripped off. When I think of Beverly's story, words like betrayal, fraud, harassment, abuse, and ongoing psychological torment come to mind. That would be distressing enough, but what makes it more shocking is it was all done by two of her grandsons who stole property from her, used her wealth to establish a career they really weren't qualified for, and then siphoned off her wealth to enrich themselves. When Beverly began to catch on, the grandsons yelled at their grandma and told her she had dementia and that she was losing her grip and didn't know what she was talking about. Their father, Beverly's son, piled on. Yet Beverly unearthed the truth with the help of her caregiver and granddaughters, and she fought back. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say this is a story of wealth, greed, family dysfunction, treachery, and anguish. It's the story of how a 94-year-old lady, a nice lady, a generally non-confrontational lady, got pushed to her limit. Even though Beverly didn't understand all the ins and outs of the financial moves that were made against her, she did understand right and wrong. And in the end, she decided that was worth a fight. I'm Leslie Gold. This is A Life's Story. First, Beverly, just tell me about your childhood.
To me, it's like everyone else's. It was a lot of fun. It was a childhood, loving parents and loving brothers. I have three brothers that were so good to me. It's hard to say. Wherever they went, they let me follow them. And I was the kid sister. And they never said scram or anything like that. They were good guys. When I was born, right afterwards, maybe 3 months after, we had a terrible hurricane in Florida. My father had a great business there, but everything was knocked down. Florida was flat, and the hurricane was bad. That's according to my parents. The town and the beach was just down. All the homes, they were destroyed except my parents. And all the people that lived around us came in to sit with us until it died down. So afterwards, my mother said, let's get going. If this is what's going to happen, every couple of years, we went back to New York. And we went into my grandparents' home.
Did you do the rest of your childhood in New York?
No, I did not. After a while, we went back to Florida. Because my dad had a great business. He liked it there, and he wanted to be there. My mother, you know, he talked my mother into it.
What was your father's business?
Well, they were stores with food stores. It was very good. He had great delicatessens. I just went along with the kids, and I did okay. In high school, it was different. I became an actress. You know, I was always doing something that was fun.
During high school, Beverly worked at her parents' business for a while.
I used to be at the register, but that wasn't for me. But otherwise, I didn't help them. I would have rather get a job on my own.
Did you do any education after high school?
My mother wanted me to go immediately into college like my brothers did. And that's when the war was starting. And I told my mother, I said, right now, I was very interested in office work because I had an aunt that was doing that. And she said it was nice and it was easy to do.
Beverly and her family went back and forth from Florida to New York a few times as she was growing up. And as a young woman, Beverly got a job in New York City. What was your first job that you got on your own?
Oh, well, I got a job in the city. I decided I'll get an office job and see what it was to do the bookkeeping. Oh. So that's where I got really started with the bookkeeping. I had more learning there than I think any college could have given me.
What are your memories, Beverly, of World War II?
The first memory I have is my mother. My brother was doing work for the Army with electricity. The phone rings and it was Yom Kippur night. And my mother didn't let anyone answer the telephone. She said, look, she said, I'm so worried anyway. I don't want you to pick up the phone. So none of us picked up the phone. We get a call the next day. A friend of my brother said he was calling to say goodbye, that he was going to England. And my mother never forgave herself that we didn't answer the phone because the war starts and here she couldn't talk to her son.
Right. So did your brother survive the war?
It's a miracle.
Beverly was befriended at work by another woman. She was a bit older than Beverly, but they became good friends. And when this woman moved out to Ohio, she asked Beverly to come and visit her and her daughter. It would turn out to be a fateful trip.
I said, fine, I'll be happy to visit you because I do miss you. Well, I went there. Her daughter, a lovely girl, she had a date. And she said, they all go to Club Gloria. That's up where the Ohio State is. They call it Club Gloria. All the kids went there and they danced and had music and all that. I said, wherever you want to go is okay with me. So she introduced me to some little guy and we all went together. The guy was too little for me. And I'm not so big, little either. He was a nice guy though. So we all met the boys and we were having a good time and everyone sat around, and who sat around me was Alvin. He had a date with somebody else and he kept talking to me and ignoring the other girl. And I said, gee, what kind of a guy is this? He's ignoring his girlfriend. And he had to take the girl back because she was going to school there at Ohio State. And they have to be in before midnight, the girls. So he said goodbye to everybody, and he went and took the girl back. At Club Gloria was on the campus, so he came right back. He came to sit next to me. He said he just met the girl that day, that time. I asked him about the girl. I said, well, it's nice knowing you, but I'm leaving tomorrow. And he said, well, he's always in New York.
Apparently, Alvin knew what he wanted and wasted no time.
We said goodbye, and I get to New York, and that night, who is there? Alvin.
Alvin and Beverly saw each other for a few months, as much as would allow when you are commuting from Ohio to New York City.
We decided to get married because I really liked him. He was such a sweet guy. I never knew anybody like him. He was the greatest.
So you didn't decide within 2 weeks to get married?
Well, I knew right away. I said, this is a guy. I never went out with such a nice guy. I mean, he was just different. Maybe because he was from Ohio, I don't know. A lot of the guys that I met were pretty fancy, schmancy guys. I didn't care for them. I said to my mother, look, Mom, If I marry Alvin, I don't want a big wedding.
Beverly, the impression I'm getting is you were really not a very fancy person.
No.
You wanted a guy who was kind of down to earth, and you didn't want a big wedding, and you came from, you know, a hardworking family.
Absolutely.
Is that the right impression that I'm getting?
Yes, you're right.
So you moved to Ohio?
Yes, absolutely.
That's a big change, right? Because you're from Florida and New York, and now you go to Ohio. Did you have any fears about moving to Ohio?
No, not at all. It was a very small town when I went there. Very small town. It's big now. I understand, quite large. But it was a nice community, very lovely people, and it worked out fine.
What town was it that you settled?
Columbus, Ohio.
Tell me about your marriage.
Well, it was great. And then, you know, the marriage was fine. And I had 4 children. I also a daughter and 3 boys.
It is important to understand the Schottenstein family tree. Alvin, Beverly's husband, was one of 4 boys. Leon, Alvin, Saul, and Jerome, or Jerry, as he was sometimes called. These 4 boys all had an equal stake in the family business, which would eventually become a retailing behemoth. More on that in a bit. For now, just know that Alvin was one of 4 brothers, and Beverly and Alvin had 4 children themselves: Chuck, Gary, Randy, and Bobby. There is a drawing of the Schottenstein family tree on our website, alifesstory.net.
And my husband ran his business. He did a very good job.
Right. So I have read that your husband did a very good job with the businesses. Very good job may be the understatement of the year. A Schottenstein retail store was started by Alvin's father, Ephraim Schottenstein, in 1917. The business, now known as Schottenstein Stores Corporation, was willed to Ephraim's 4 sons, Alvin, Jerome, Leon, and Saul. Alvin was one of 4 brothers who had an ownership share in the growing Schottenstein empire, but really, 2 of the brothers were leading the way, Alvin and Jerome. Together, they pioneered discount retailing, and they would become known as some of retailing's sharpest operators. Alvin was particularly adept at buying overstock or closeout goods in bulk. Alvin became president of the Schottenstein Store Group. Today, the Schottenstein Group is worth billions and counts among their holdings retail chains like Big Lots, DSW Shoes, American Eagle Outfitters, and Albertsons. But even back then, when Alvin and Jerome were running the business, they were acquiring chains like EJ Corvettes and Value City Furniture. As best I can estimate, the Schottenstein Group at this time was doing well over $100 million in sales. A very good job indeed.
He built a department store. He said he's going to make the department store with good stuff, and it's going to be half the price of every other department store in the United States. Everybody knew about the bargain. They did very well. It sold out. He'd buy so many kids' outfits. He'd have to run again. They were taken all the time. He'd have to get the new one.
That name of that store was?
Schottenstein Department Store.
Did it go from 1 to more than 1?
Yes, they did.
How did the other retail chains get added? I know he was in charge of others as well.
Well, yes, he did. He started doing the buyout. A lot of big stores went broke, and he would buy them out. But one thing about Alvin, he never wanted to take anything. Like you say, he never would steal anything from anybody. What he did was sit down and agree with them. He said, look, I want it cheap. I want to buy it from you. I don't want to take it away from you. I want you to make a deal, and I want to make a deal. And that's the way he worked all of his life. He didn't want to do anything to hurt anybody. Alvin was an extremely giving guy. And he was friendly with people in Columbus, and he helped them. He helped everybody.
Were you involved at all in any of the businesses?
No, I didn't put my 2 cents into anything.
How did Alvin die?
He had a heart attack. The younger one, Jerry, was a tough cookie, a real tough cookie. He was always arguing about things. Jerry went bankrupt twice. Alvin didn't say anything. He fixed him up again, and he opened another store. Well, anyway, regardless, so Jerry ran the furniture.
So it was really, this business was really built with Jerome and Alvin.
Yeah. There was an argument there, and I didn't know about it. I knew afterwards there was an argument with Jerome and Alvin. And Alvin took it to heart. And Alvin had that heart attack that evening.
Wait, he had a heart attack on the day he argued with Jerry?
The day he argued. The day they had an argument.
Oh, my goodness.
He took it to heart.
Did he die at home?
At home. At home.
Oh.
The TV was still on and everything. Everything was...
That must have been a terrible shock for you.
It was terrible. I kept calling him and calling him, and he was sitting up in the bed.
I had read, Beverly, that Alvin was beloved by the employees at these stores.
Yes. I mean, I found this out after he passed away. I didn't know what Alvin was doing.
What was he doing?
What he did when things were bad for other people, he found out that they were in trouble. He found out accidentally, like he didn't go around asking everyone, what are you doing with your life? He would help them, and he said, don't tell anybody. He said, what do you need, and how can I help you? And you know, each one had a different story to tell him, and he helped them. He helped them. When he passed away, many, many, many people came up to me at home and told me what he did for them and how they blessed them.
Did you ever date after Alvin died?
I was never interested, but when I came down to Florida, I mean, people would want to take me out for lunch, so okay, one or two, but I was never interested in any. Nobody made me interested in anyone.
Kathy Schottenstein is a granddaughter of Beverly. Kathy's father is Beverly's son, Chuck. Kathy turned out to be a pivotal character in Beverly's fight against her other grandchildren. You'll be hearing a lot from Kathy during this episode. What are your memories of your nanny as a child? I mean, what kind of person was she when you were a kid?
Always incredibly elegant. To me, my grandmother was the most beautiful woman in the world growing up. I remember going sometimes to New York to see Broadway plays, and one time someone actually stopped her and asked for her autograph because they just assumed that she was a famous person. She had this red wavy hair, and it was kind of just cut a little above her shoulders, and she was always dressed so well. She didn't ever fit into Columbus, Ohio. She was sort of this persona that needed to be in Beverly Hills or New York City. And even in New York City, I remember someone saying, can I get your autograph? They thought she was someone important. But, you know, she was also just my grandmother. I went there every Friday night for Shabbos dinner with my dad. My parents divorced when I was 2 years old. So my parents shared joint custody, and so essentially 9 times out of 10, if I were with my dad, I was with my grandmother as well. She kind of became a surrogate mother. I grew up with her. I was the one that was there every Friday night. I was, you know, she was at my graduation. She was at every clarinet concert, all the little things that I did. My grandmother was there. She was always just very elegant, sort of feminine icon to me.
Was she warm to the grandkids when you guys were little?
She was always very loving and warm, not so much physically. I don't have a lot of memories of her holding my hand or necessarily hugging me. I don't know if that's a generational thing or if that's just not the way she is. not very physical, but she would do things, little things, which seem kind of silly now. But I remember every time I'd go there on Friday night, there'd be an apple turnover in a little white bag, bakery bag, because she went to the bakery to make sure that she got my favorite dessert and was always waiting for me. And I would drink soda. We called it pop, actually, in Columbus. And there would be the little glass bottles, like the old-fashioned bottles of soda with a straw, which I always thought was really cool because, like, ooh, look, I'm drinking not in a can. I have, like, a little glass bottle. And she would do those things because she knew that I thought it was really special. And I did think it was really special.
Alvin's brother Leon had predeceased Alvin. With Alvin's death, that left Jerry and Saul.
I may be wrong, but it strikes me now you have a difficult business dilemma.
Well, the thing is, there was no business. Jerome took over and boom, boom, boom. It was impossible for my children. Jerome was, you do this or else go to hell. It had to be his way or no way. And that's the way it had to be. It was very, very difficult. The kids came. They said, they can't live this way. My kids were zero to him. Zero. He probably would treat them just like you treated someone that you hired off the street. It was very difficult to end the thing. I mean, he wanted the entire business for him. I mean, this belonged to everyone. This was right. Alvin's business, and Alvin never felt it only belonged to him. See, Saul was neither here nor there. Jerome talked him into giving him his share. Well, what happened? Jerome had the whole share. He had Saul's share and his share.
So Jerome put himself in charge.
He put himself in charge. Jerome was a damn lucky guy. A damn lucky guy.
And with that, the first colossal Schottenstein battle ensued. Beverly and her then young adult children felt that the business belonged to the families of all four of the brothers. Some of her children wanted to make a career inside the family business, but according to Beverly, Jerome did not want her children in the business and essentially bullied them out of it. It was discovered at that time that brother Saul was convinced to transfer his share of the business to Jerome, essentially handing him control. This transfer was done secretly. An epic legal battle took place. Beverly's branch of the family tree sued, saying they were denied their share of the family business, and they sought $150 million for Alvin's share. The case took 5 long years to settle, and it got ugly, very ugly.
And with Jerome and his son started fighting. They started hitting one another. It was terrible.
Oh, my God.
It was, so I said, look, kids, do what you want to do. I said, we can sue them and try to get what we worth. It was very sad, very sad that it had to happen.
Granddaughter Kathy.
They all got a big chunk of money when they settled out of the business. They got almost, I think, almost like over $90 million together. So if you divide it equally, each of my grandmother and each of her four kids got around $18 million, just right at 1990 when they got out of the business, okay? Bobby managed to do all these weird investments, shady deals with crooked people, and essentially lost all his money. And when his family, when his sons and wife found out that he had basically blown their entire inheritance, created major conflict within that family.
Keeping track of all the Schottensteins is not easy, so I'll do these reminders now and again. Bobby is one of Beverly's four children, Chuck, Gary, Randy, and Bobby. Enter into the saga Evan and Avi Schottenstein, Bobby's sons, Beverly's grandsons. Remember these names? You'll be hearing them a lot. Hi, it's Leslie. I hope you are enjoying this episode of A Life's Story so far. We can do this for you. We'll produce a personal audio documentary for a beloved family member. We will capture their life story and present it in a beautiful piece of audio storytelling that you and your family will treasure for years to come. Details are at the very end of this episode.
The wife, not Bobby, she kept coming over and bothering me. Give Evan a job. Let him take care of your money. I said, he doesn't know anything about this. And Chuck was taking care of a couple of different men, and he was overlooking everything. So Chuck said, don't do it, Mom. And she kept bothering me and nudging me. Please, please take my son. It was terrible. So I said to Chuck, look, let the kid learn something. Just watch him. He said, he said, it's not a good idea to take a kid to let him do it. But I said, okay, let him do it. The biggest mistake I made.
Who was managing your money before you decided to turn it over to your grandchildren?
Whatever money my husband left, Chuck took over. And we were in Columbus, Ohio, and he took over. He took care of everything, my expenses and everything. He did a good job.
Yes, he did a good job.
Yeah.
Beverly's son, Chuck, did do a good job. He took Beverly's $18 million, and with years of careful oversight over two experienced money managers, the team built it up. When Evan took over the account in 2006, it was worth about $100 million. Did you give them your entire portfolio to manage?
No, I didn't. I did not, but Evan went and took it upon himself to fire my two good men, and I knew nothing about this. You see, I lived in a different city. He went and fired my regular men. He said, he told them that I wanted it that way. I want him to have everything.
Evan had his sights set on an apartment that Beverly owned in New York City. He complained he didn't like living with his roommates, so he wanted to live in the apartment that she owned.
So I said, well, you're going to have to pay rent. I said, you're starting to work for me, you're going to pay rent. It wasn't even that much.
No, it's the principle.
Yeah. No, I said, you're working, yeah. You have to pay rent.
Right. Said, I agree with you.
And I never paid attention to the man, did he pay his rent this month or anything? Nothing like that. He said, okay, I'll pay his rent. Then it was a big apartment. He let his brother live with him.
I want to put the word rent in quotes. It was quite a deal. Beverly tells me the rent was about $350 a month. Even in the early 2000s when this was happening, $350 a month in Manhattan wasn't enough to park your car, never mind rent a large apartment. You'd think the grandsons would be grateful for such a deal, but it wasn't enough for Evan and Avi.
I found out that they forged my name and they said they owned the apartment. They forged my name.
Oh, my God.
But they said too many years have gone by. I can't do any. I can't sue. I can't do a darn thing. Who the hell knows?
They stole an apartment from you.
He once made a remark. He said, boy, your handwriting is very easy for me to write. He once said that to me, Evan. All of a sudden, I hear Evan is in California. I said, what are you doing in California? Aren't you working anymore? He says, oh, I brought the stuff to California because Avi, he's going to help me. First of all, I said, you don't take my money without my permission. I said, I don't go for that kind of stuff. I said, you're handling my money. And you have to check with me. What I heard was they got a tremendous bonus because they told him how much money I had that they were bringing in. And they gave a big bonus first.
They were only valuable to the firm because of your money.
That's right.
Yes.
That's what they did with my money. And that's when a lot of stuff started with me. I didn't go for that crap that they were running with my money from one end of the earth to another. That's what it seemed to me.
So I know they forged your name on the condo.
Yes.
Co-op or the condo. Having changed brokerage houses myself, I know there's a lot of paperwork involved.
I signed nothing.
And thus began years of underhanded moves, questionable transactions, misrepresentations, lies, and outright fraud. Strap in. Just when you think, oh my God, this is terrible, it gets worse. But then it gets even worse.
And if I call him, what's going on? He says, I can't talk to you now. I'm very, very busy. I can't talk to you now.
They're managing your money. I mean, saying in air quotes, they're managing.
He managed my money for himself.
They took over the apartment one floor below her shortly after she moved there. Because what happened was my grandmother's brother, Melvin, was ill and living full-time in Columbus, Ohio. And she wanted him to live below her in Florida and to move. But he was very sick. So my grandmother helped him the condo below her became available. My grandmother helped them purchase it for her brother, on behalf of her brother. And he never made it there because he ended up dying in Columbus. And just really a few weeks before he died, they had him change the deed to the apartment that he had never stepped foot in into their name.
So now Bobby and his wife, Caroline, parents of Evan and Avi, live in the condo one floor below Beverly, another home, it seems, that they didn't pay for. They are close by and meshed in her day-to-day living. Meet Dawn Henry, Beverly's at-home caregiver since 2016. Tell me how long you have worked for Beverly.
4.5 years.
Okay. And when you came in, did you immediately notice something was strange going on, or did it take some time?
Immediately.
Tell me what set you off.
Well, I saw how Caroline was aggressive to her, talked down to her, controlling. And I remember they went to Israel after 2 weeks when I started, and they left her with $300. And we had a problem with the shutters on the apartment. So we had the guy downstairs fix it. And all they left in the house was eggs, orange juice, milk, and applesauce. They brought her checkbook downstairs. And her daughter was here upstairs. I had to use my credit card to buy food. And when they came back, I gave Beverly the receipt and she made out a check for me. So I know right away that something was not right with this family.
Before all this, it was also discovered that my Uncle Bobby had gone into, and possibly Evan too, we don't know the specifics, but they went into my grandmother's safe deposit box at the local bank and stole millions of dollars of her jewelry, all her jewelry, which had totaled millions of dollars, including her engagement ring from my grandfather, her 7-carat engagement ring. And that all happened before all this. So my grandmother has no jewelry and hasn't had it for years.
How did he have access to her safety deposit box?
He had another key. She just trusted them with everything. And I guess you can't really blame her. I mean, you're thinking you're giving your son another key to your safe deposit box to make sure everything's okay. And we don't even know. I think he probably took that jewelry early on, but we don't even know when he took it. We just know it's gone. They've come up with different narratives about what happened to it, but it's never been found.
The reason why she knew about the jewelry is because she said to Bobby once that she would like to bring home a piece to in the apartment, you know, if she's going out. That's when they told her that it's all gone.
And Bobby said, well, I needed it because I got involved with some bad people and I had to use it to pay off the mafia. That was the story that they first told. Since then, it's been an evolving narrative of what really happened with the jewelry. The one thing we know is they took it and we've never seen it again.
First of all, that mafia thing sounds like complete bullshit to me.
Oh,
yeah. The idea of someone just taking her jewelry and sell it, jewelry is so personal.
Right.
It's so personal. It's like ripping clothes off somebody's body and selling it. You know, these were her things that she loved.
Yes.
She put them away safely and one day they're gone. Like there was no regard for her, you know, her relationship with those things. And those things also, my parents also, you know, my father would buy my mother jewelry and it wasn't to the same level as yours. But that after my father passed, you know, those things meant more
right.
to my mother after
right.
because they came from my father. And I'm sure that's true of Beverly, right?
Right. There's a story associated with those things. And she would say like, oh, Alvin got me this when he was in New York. You know, and he died very young. He was in his early 60s. So those tangible things can hold on to the memories, and that was just completely taken away.
Right. Caregiver Dawn, when did you start to see Evan and or Avi interact with Beverly?
Not much of Avi, but Evan was kind of, when he came in from New York, he would not come upstairs. If he does, it's like 2 minutes. The last time that before this thing came about, we saw a lot of package. He was here like 2 weeks. He never came upstairs. We saw a lot of package came to the door. So Beverly realized it's for them downstairs because we didn't order anything from Amazon. So what happened is she called Evan and he came down and picked them up. He spent like 2 minutes. It wasn't, they weren't loving. You can know the difference between love and users.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't caring, not one bit.
Dawn, Beverly's caregiver, knows something stinks as she watches Evan and Avi shred Beverly's financial records, including her statements. Worried and suspicious, Dawn decides to ring the alarm bell. There is much more treachery ahead for Beverly, and there's much more to her saga. Find out what happens when Dawn and Kathy mobilize to help Beverly fight back in our next episode. I'm Leslie Gold. Thank you for listening to A Life's Story. Hi, it's Leslie. As I create these episodes, I can't help but think of my own parents. They're gone now, and I wish I did this with them. I'd give just about anything to hear them tell their stories in their own voices again. And I thought, well, that's a service worth providing. So now you can get the full life story treatment for your loved one. We capture the life story of an important person in your life, say your parent or grandparent, and create a beautiful piece of audio storytelling that they will love and that you will treasure. You'll be proud to share it with your family, one day your kids and your grandkids. And the personal audio pieces include all the bells and whistles you hear in the podcast episodes. We do in-depth interviews, we score with music, use historical sound, we build a story arc, provide professional narration, and add additional voices. These pieces come out beautifully. And speaking from personal experience, one day you'll be really glad you have it. We are creating personal love stories too. So go to alifesstory.net for more information. alifesstory.net. You can book a call with us from the site, and we can discuss who you have in mind for a personal project in a totally no-pressure call. alifesstory.net.